headlines this hour. Iran's president warns the U.S. against undermining regional security, saying Tehran will have a, quote, harsh response to any mistake by Washington or its allies. The Palestinian resistance movement Hamas condemns the U.S. president's pro-Israel rhetoric upon arrival in Tel Aviv. Also ahead, the European Commission increases inflation forecasts for both Europe and the Eurozone as the war in Ukraine continues to take a heavy toll on the continent's economy. Well, welcome to our studios here in the capital, Tehran. This is News. Thanks for joining us. Iran's president warns the U.S. and its allies that any mistake by them in West Asia will meet the Iranian nation's harsh response. Ibrahim Raisi said the nation will not tolerate any crisis or insecurity in the region. He said that Iran's defense capabilities have brought security to the region. The president also said interference by foreigners, the U.S. in particular, will only jeopardize regional security. Raisi warned Israel that normalization with certain Arab states in the region will never guarantee the regime's security. The Iranian president also censured some regional states for playing into the hands of Western countries in importing instability and terrorism to West Asia. The Palestinian Resistance Front says U.S. President Joe Biden's remarks upon arrival in Tel Aviv emphasized that his support for the Israeli regime. According to Hamas spokesman Hazem Qassem, Biden's statements are in line with the criminal intentions of those who seek to form coalitions with Israel. Right after his plane touched down in the occupied territories, Biden called himself a Zionist. He also doubled down on Washington's military support for Israel and the strong bonds between Americans and Israelis. This is the first leg of Biden's three-day visit, which will also take him to Saudi Arabia. His administration is facing criticism for failing to hold Tel Aviv and Riyadh accountable for their killings of journalists Shireen Abu Akleh and Jamal Khashoggi.
A great Zionist and one of the closest friends of the Israeli regime ever. A true friend and a staunch supporter of Tel Aviv and the Jewish people. This is how Israeli leaders have described U.S. President Joe Biden, who is on a three-day visit to the region. Biden landed at Ben-Gurion Airport on Wednesday afternoon for his first trip to Israel as president. Biden described his arrival as a homecoming, as he was welcomed by Israel's leaders on the tarmac. While he will be spending some 48 hours with Israeli leaders, he will pay an hour-long visit to Bethlehem and meet with Palestinian President Mahmoud Abbas. Palestinian officials say they have not pinned their hopes on Biden's visit, which they see just as another step towards supporting the occupying regime of Israel.
We have no expectations whatsoever from this visit. The picture is very clear. Mr. Biden is only coming here to support Israel, to try to promote strategic military and intelligence alliance between some Arab countries and Israel and the United States.
All indications show that Mr. Biden and his administration have no interest whatsoever in really supporting the Palestinian people or in exercising any form of pressure on Israel to stop settlement activities and its violations of human rights.
Palestinian people have no hope that Biden's visit will bear any fruit. Like his predecessors, they say, Biden's policies represent the U.S.'s long-standing allegiance to Israel at the expense of Palestinian freedom and dignity. Some Palestinians remain skeptical that such a trip will have any tangible impact on their lives.
There haven't been any changes for decades, and the policy is the same. Israel is a U.S. ally.
He's not the first American president to visit the occupied territories. We saw nothing after every visit. They all agree on the same issues. What's being suggested by the Americans is only economic solutions, but not political ones. There is no talk about a Palestinian state or restoring the Palestinian rights.
The Palestinians, meanwhile, are still hoping that the American leader would fulfill long-overdue promises on the Palestinian issue, rather than offering them more economic incentives. Experts say the last leg of Biden's West Asia tour will be its most significant one. The U.S. president is to fly to Saudi Arabia, obviously as part of more steps toward normalization of ties between the Israeli regime and the Arab world at the expense of Palestinians' rights. Mona Qandil, Occupy Ramallah.
Let's talk about this a little bit more with Mohammer Abusada. He's a professor of political science at Al-Azhar University. Welcome. We just heard a report where obviously there is no signs of any hope by anyone that was talked about in that report, including whether it's an analyst or just everyday Palestinians. And the U.S. president is here when his first, it seems, thoughts were to double down in reality the military support for Israel. In that regard, what message do you think he's sending?
Well, good evening, first of all. Let me say that the visit by U.S. President Joe Biden to the region, we all know that this visit came after reluctance of the U.S. president to come to the region. The main purpose of this visit is to basically push Saudi Arabia and other Gulf countries to increase its oil and gas produced to the international market as a result of the Russian invasion of Ukraine, which resulted in the in higher prices in gas and oil. So we all know that the visit is very much, as President Biden said today, that his visit to the region and to Saudi Arabia is to defend U.S. National interest. Now, his visit also to Israel is also to defend his own electoral interest or his own electoral agenda. We all know that the U.S. is going into mid-elections in November of this year, 2022, and the Democratic Party and President Biden are not doing in those in public opinion polls in the U.S. And by visiting Israel and signing the so-called Jerusalem Joint Declaration with Israel, in which he committed U.S. Support for Israeli security, we all know that the president is trying to very much buy the votes of the Jewish voters in the U.S. and also the financial assistance and support by the Jewish lobby in the U.S. Unfortunately, in the midst of all of that, we only hear very little about the Palestinian case, the Palestinian issue. It seems to me that the Palestinian issue is not on the agenda of President Biden. Even in the joint declaration between the U.S. and Israel, the declaration did not say Israel and the U.S. It said only Biden's commitment to the two-state solution, in which means that Israel doesn't accept even the two-state solution formula for the Palestinian-Israeli conflict. The only thing that came in the joint declaration about the Palestinians, it also spoke about economic support for the Palestinians. It spoke about dealing with the daily affairs of the Palestinians in West Bank and Gaza. It didn't really say anything about the political rights of the Palestinians. It didn't say anything about halting Israeli settlement expansion and creeping annexations in the West Bank and East Jerusalem.
Thank you very much for that. We appreciate it. That's Mohammer Abusada, professor of political science.
Thank you.
At Al-Azhar University. Many thanks. Moving on, Tehran has dismissed a Swedish court ruling in the case of Iranian national Hamid Nouri, who was on trial for allegations leveled against him by the notorious anti-Iran terrorist group, the MKO. Foreign Ministry spokesman Nasser Kanani condemned the ruling as politically motivated. He said the decision is, quote, distorted and lacks legal basis. Earlier, the Swedish court handed the Iranian citizen a life sentence. Hamid Nouri was arrested in 2019 over allegations of human rights violations against MKO members back in the 1980s. Iran says these allegations are, quote, baseless, and his trial is a political pageantry. Last month, in a short phone call with his family, Nouri said that he was tortured while in prison and denied medical attention, despite his deteriorating physical condition. Editor of Veterans Today, Kevin Barrett, says it is shameful and hypocritical of the West to sponsor and arm the MKO terrorist group, which is responsible for the death of over 17,000 Iranians.
It's really curious because we're living in an era in which so-called terrorism has been systematically demonized, and the United States has proclaimed that it's supposedly leading a global war on terror that will never end, inaugurated, of course, by the false flag events of September 11th, 2001. It's really strange because this, if any group on earth deserves to be targeted and disbanded forcibly, it's this group. They're completely out of control. And it's shameful that the West has been sponsoring these people and arming them and helping them organize and giving them sanctuary in a number of countries so that they can plan these acts of violence. And they're not even hiding the fact that they are violent, that they're not committed to any kind of open society values whatsoever. So once again, the hypocritical West, which pretends to be in favor of liberal values and free press and so on and so forth, is actually supporting this group that murders 17,000 people in Iran and attacks journalists and basically is running around like another Jim Jones, Jonestown kind of group, except instead of having to run off to Guyana, they're being put up in the best kinds of places across Europe. So it's completely shameful and it's bizarre. And it's almost, it would be funny if people weren't suffering so badly from it.
Sri Lanka's president has sent his letter of resignation to Parliament shortly after arriving in Singapore. That is according to the Parliamentary Speaker's Office. Gotabaya Rajapaksa resigned by email after protesters overran his palace at the weekend. He fled to the Maldives on Wednesday and left there for Singapore one day later. As president, Rajapaksa enjoyed immunity from arrest, and he is believed to have wanted to go abroad before stepping down to avoid the possibility of being detained. Under Sri Lanka's constitution, Prime Minister Ranil Wickremesinghe would automatically become acting president until Parliament can appoint a successor. Rajapaksa is accused of mismanaging the economy to a point where the country has run out of foreign exchange. Sri Lanka has been the scene of massive protests over the past few weeks. The U.S. government's latest data shows inflation in the country reached a new 40-year high in June. According to the Labor Department, the Consumer Price Index was at 9.1% last month. That's higher than the U.S. officials had expected and is the fastest increase in four decades. Energy prices also posted their biggest annual rise in more than 40 years. Many Americans are blaming the U.S. monetary policies and the current administration's mismanagement for the high inflation.
No, I don't think the government's done a good job because all last year this began and they did nothing because they thought it was temporary. And, you know, during the pandemic, everybody got passed out money, including stores and all of that. And so it's like too much money floating around. They were very late to the game.
Well, I think the Federal Reserve said it was temporary, so I think maybe we could blame the Fed more than we can blame President Biden. They kept saying it was temporary for quite a while, and they finally had to change their tune.
Following the release of the data, President Joe Biden acknowledged that the inflation rate is unacceptably high. Still, he argued the figure is out of date and does not reflect a clear drop in energy prices since mid-June. The central bank last month implemented the biggest interest rate hike in nearly 30 years to rein in the inflation, but so far that has not been effective. The European Commission has increased inflation forecasts for both Europe and the Eurozone as the Russia-Ukraine war continues to take a heavy toll on the continent's economy. The Commission says that inflation will hit 7.6% in the Eurozone this year. That is up from its projection of 6.1% back in May. The 2023 inflation has also been revised up by 1.3% for Europe as a whole. The inflation forecast has been revised up 8.3% for this year. The figure is 1.5% higher than the body's forecast in May. The continent's inflation forecast for next year has also been hiked to 4.6%. The war in Ukraine, coupled with the West's anti-Russia sanctions, have driven up fuel costs. Conflict has also triggered record-high price rises. The European Commission admits its current strategy to compensate for reduced energy supplies from Russia is inadequate. Surging oil and gas prices in the EU resulting from sanctions imposed on Moscow are contributing to economic turmoil across the 27-country bloc. Jerome Hughes has more from Brussels.
Europe is currently experiencing a heat wave. It means that overall energy consumption is lower than usual. However, winter is fast approaching. The EU has cut energy imports from Russia in retaliation for the war in Ukraine. The bloc has agreed deals with the US, Norway and Qatar to import liquefied natural gas.
Is this enough? No, I don't think it is enough. And this is the reason why on July the 20th we will come with further proposals.
If these proposals fall short, the EU faces a major energy crisis this winter. Economists are already painting a very gloomy picture.
We believe that we are going to face a recession during the winter, given all the headwinds we are facing right now, the energy situation, but also the cost of living situation that is having a strong impact on consumption.
Eurozone finance ministers claim all the blame rests with Moscow. Analysts say EU leaders are hurting their own citizens by placing enormous sanctions on Moscow. At the same time, Russia's economy seems to be performing well. Aside from soaring energy and food prices in the EU, there is worrying volatility in financial markets. The European Central Bank is raising interest rates. The euro is currently very weak, which has the effect of pushing up inflation even more. Croatia is due to become the 20th member of the Eurozone in January. The EU describes this as an historic step. The question is, will Croatians have much to celebrate by the time they start using the struggling euro? Jerome Hughes, Brussels.
Construction workers turned out in several cities across Panama to show that they are fed up with an inflation rate that's going through the roof. Union members took part in massive protests, paralyzing the streets in the capital, Panama City. They have accused the government of robbing the poor to feed the rich. Wednesday's demonstration followed weeks of angry protests in the Central American nation. Protesters have been erecting roadblocks to demand a halt to rising fuel and food costs. They also want the government to curb public spending, with the exception of education, as consumers are bearing the brunt of the steadily creeping prices. The government has announced price controls for some food items, along with some austerity measures, but the demos continue regardless. Panama is not the only country bordering the Caribbean Sea that is plagued by protests. Haiti is also witnessing a wave of unrest as anger mounts over fuel shortages. Protesters block roads in the capital, Port-au-Prince. Gas stations across the country are mostly closed in light of a turf war between rival gangs near one of Haiti's major fuel terminals. The week of gang violence in Port-au-Prince has left some 90 people dead, accelerating a downward spiral in the security situation. Political unrest rocked Haiti a year ago when its president was gunned down, but politics continues to be in a state of disarray, with the office of the president still vacant. An understaffed and ill-equipped police force that is unable to control street gangs has worsened the situation. And that is it for World News. Bye-bye for now.
IRIB English Radio. Please log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
In the limelight.
Former President Donald J. Trump attempted to make the January 6, 2021 march on the Capitol appear spontaneous, even as he and his team intentionally assembled and galvanized a violence-prone mob to disrupt certification of his electoral defeat. The House committee investigating the attack showed on Tuesday, 12th of July. The article you're about to hear has been written by the New York Times journalists Luke Broadwater and Alan Feuer. The piece is titled, Trump Sought to Conceal Plans to March to Capitol, panel says. Former President Donald J. Trump attempted to make the January 6, 2021 march on the Capitol appear spontaneous, even as he and his team intentionally assembled and galvanized a violence-prone mob to disrupt certification of his electoral defeat. The House committee investigating the attack showed on Tuesday, 12th of July. The President of the United States is going to have us march there in the Capitol, Kylie Jane Kremer, an organizer of the Save America rally on 6th of January 2021, wrote in a 4th of January text shown by the panel on Tuesday as it detailed Donald Trump's efforts to gather his backers in Washington for a final last-ditch effort to overturn his election loss. Ms. Kremer added that Donald Trump was going to just call for it unexpectedly. Mr. Trump weighed announcing the move, according to documents obtained from the National Archives, which provided the investigators with a draft tweet that said, "I will be making a big speech at 10 a.m. on 6th of January 2021 at the Ellipse, south of the White House. Please arrive early. Massive crowds expected. March to the Capitol afterwards. Stop the steal." The tweet was never sent, but it was the latest evidence presented by the committee of how Donald Trump undertook a public and private effort to channel angry supporters, including right-wing extremists, towards the Capitol building, where Vice President Mike Pence and lawmakers were gathered to confirm Joseph R. Biden Jr.'s victory as president-elect. For more than a year, Donald Trump and his defenders have described the violence at the Capitol as a freewheeling, peaceful protest gone awry. But the hearing on Tuesday, 12th of July, laid out how the former president took a guiding role, not only in bringing the mob fueled by his election lies to Washington on that day, but also in the plan to direct it up to Capitol Hill, disregarding the advice of his closest aides. Donald Trump summoned a mob to Washington, D.C. and ultimately spurred that mob to wage a violent attack on our democracy, said Representative Benny Thompson, Democrat of Mississippi and the chairman of the House Committee. In its seventh hearing to lay out its findings, the committee situated Donald Trump at the center of the quasi-legal efforts to derail the political process and also at the heart of the unprecedented chaos at the Capitol. Over nearly 3 hours, it introduced evidence from rally organizers, from rioters and aides inside the White House, who said the former president had inspired and directed what transpired on that day. While it did not draw any direct link between Donald Trump and the domestic extremists who orchestrated and stood at the forefront of the Capitol attack, the House Committee set forth in meticulous detail how Donald Trump's words and actions united a disparate set of far-right groups and militias and spurred them to plot a violent effort to disrupt the peaceful transfer of power. "The president got everybody riled up and told everybody to head on down," said one of the witnesses at the hearing, Stephen Ayers, an Ohio man who pleaded guilty last month to disorderly conduct charges connected to the Capitol attack. Stephen Ayers added, "We basically were just following what Donald Trump had said." Even Brad Parscale, Mr. Trump's one-time campaign manager, blamed his former boss for the deadly violence that ensued, according to evidence shown by the committee on Tuesday, 12th of July. "A sitting president asking for civil war. I have lost faith," he wrote in text messages on 6th of January 2021 to Katrina Pearson, Donald Trump's former spokeswoman, adding that Mr. Trump's rhetoric killed someone. Even as it revealed new evidence about Donald Trump's bid to cling on to power, the committee suggested that Mr. Trump was still trying to protect himself. Representative Liz Cheney, Republican of Wyoming, and the panel's vice chairwoman, repeated her concerns that Donald Trump had been quietly interfering with the committee's work by discouraging witnesses from cooperating with the inquiry. After the panel's last presentation, she said, "Donald Trump tried to call one of its witnesses, and the witness, through a lawyer, alerted the House Committee. We will take any effort to influence witness testimony very seriously," Liz Cheney said, adding that the panel had notified the Justice Department about the matter. In a statement on Twitter, Taylor Budowich, a spokesman for Donald Trump, accused Representative Liz Cheney of spreading innuendos and lies, but did not address whether the former president had tried to contact a witness. In the hearing room on Tuesday, Representative Jamie Raskin, Democrat of Maryland, and a member of the House Select Committee, sought to draw a roadmap of Donald Trump's multi-layered effort to overturn his defeat, unfolding in three concentric rings. On the inside ring, Mr. Raskin said, was Donald Trump's pressure campaign against Mike Pence to persuade him to unilaterally throw out electoral votes for Joe Biden, as he presided over a joint session of Congress to make the official count. In the middle ring, Jamie Raskin said far-right extremist groups like the Proud Boys and the Oath Keepers, unleashed by a December 19 tweet from Donald Trump that promised a wild rally in Washington on 6th of January, took the lead in invading and occupying the Capitol. And in the outer ring, he added, a large and angry crowd, encouraged by Donald Trump's lies about election fraud, became a political force that sought to keep the former president in power. The story the committee told on Tuesday, 12th of July, took place over three chaotic weeks at the end of 2020, starting on 14th of December, when the Electoral College met and declared Joe Biden the winner of the election. Within a day, leading Republicans like Senator Mitch McConnell of Kentucky acknowledged Joe Biden's victory, and several aides to Donald Trump, including Pat Cipollone, the top lawyer in the White House, advised the president to concede defeat. Instead, the committee documented how Donald Trump ignored top administration officials and turned his hopes and attention to a group of outside advisers who were recommending a dangerous, an unprecedented plan to use the country's national security assets to seize control of voting machines and essentially to rerun the election. Through videotaped testimony, the panel brought to life a heated and often profane meeting in the Oval Office on 18th of December 2020, in which the advisers, among them the lawyer Sidney Powell and Michael Flynn, Donald Trump's former national security adviser, fought with Pat Cipollone and other White House advisers about the plan to seize the voting machines and to appoint a special counsel to investigate election fraud. Early the next morning, once the meeting ended, Donald Trump posted the message on Twitter, urging his supporters to come to Washington on 6th of January 2021, writing, "Be there, we'll be wild." The response to the message was immediate and electric. It was quickly amplified by prominent Trump supporters with influential followings like Alex Jones, the impresario of the conspiracy-laden media outlet InfoWars, and the right-wing podcaster Tim Pool. In the darkest corners of the internet, Donald Trump's supporters on websites such as thedonald.win soon began discussing bringing handcuffs, body armor, shields, bats, and pepper spray to Washington. Others talked about committing violence. "Why don't we just kill them all?" one person wrote on the chat board, 4chan. "Every last Democrat, down to the last man, last woman, and child." Donald Trump's tweet also had significant effects in the real world. Within days of it being posted, a pro-Trump organizing group called Women for America First changed its plans to hold a rally in Washington after Joe Biden's inauguration, moving the event up to 6th of January 2021. Around the same time, the committee showed the prominent Stop the Steal organizer Ali Alexander registered the website wildprotest.com, which provided information about numerous protests in Washington on 6th of January 2021, with event times, places, speakers, and details on transportation. Mr. Alexander sent a text to an associate on 5th of January 2021 saying that he believed Donald Trump was going to order him and his associates to march to the Capitol, the committee showed. On 21st of December 2020, 2 days after Donald Trump's tweet about 6th of January was posted, a group of far-right members of Congress met with the president at the White House to discuss the conservative lawyer John Eastman's theories about pressuring Mike Pence to disrupt the normal workings of the Electoral College and keep Donald Trump in power. The members of Congress at the meeting included Representatives Andy Biggs of Arizona, Matt Gaetz of Florida, Louis Gohmert of Texas, and Scott Perry of Pennsylvania, the committee said. The committee heard on Tuesday, 12th of July, from another witness, Jason Van Tattenhove, a former spokesman for the Oath Keepers militia, who described the group as a threat to democracy. The leader of the Oath Keepers, Stuart Rhodes, is one of several members of the group who has been charged with seditious conspiracy in connection with the Capitol attack. And for the first time, the committee heard testimony from a criminal defendant who was at the Capitol on 6th of January 2021 and is now facing charges. The defendant, Mr. Ailes, told the panel that he had gone to Washington at Donald Trump's direction and marched to the Capitol when the president told him to do so, and would never have gone in the first place had he known that Donald Trump's election fraud claims were false. Ayers said that his participation in the riot had ruined his life and that he felt duped and betrayed by Donald Trump. I felt like I had, like, horse blinders on. I was locked in the whole time, Mr. Ayers said. The biggest thing for me is take the blinders off. Make sure you step back and see what's going on before it's too late.
The first methodology that the Quran uses is to talk to the emotional side of the human being.
يا أيها الذين آمنوا, O you who believe, استعينوا بالصبر والصلاة.
And we have set forth for mankind in this Quran full of examples.
Minbar, a lecture on Islamic issues.
Islam is a way of life, a complete way. It's a complete way.
Today we listen to the speech of Hujjatul Islam Salim Yusuf Ali.
Brothers and sisters, we've gathered here tonight. The occasion is the night of the 15th of the blessed month of Dhul Hijjah. And this night and the day of the night, meaning tomorrow, is the special occasion of the birthday of Imam Ali ibn Muhammad al-Hadi al-Naqi, the 10th Imam, alayhi salam. And so on this occasion, I want to give my congratulations to all the believers and all the lovers of the Ahlul Bayt, alayhi salam, on this special occasion. May Allah ta'ala make us amongst those who are committed to the cause of the Ahlul Bayt, alayhi salam. And may Allah reward you all for your commemoration and your effort in taking part in this blessed gathering. For our program this evening, I wanted to mention a few points about Imam Ali al-Hadi, and inshallah, one of some stories from his life, some takeaways that we can have from this remembrance and this commemoration. But what I'd like to, inshallah, speak about this evening is one of the important teachings of Imam Ali ibn Muhammad al-Hadi, Imam Ali al-Hadi alayhi salam, which was the teaching about the special position of the Imam. You all know that Imam al-Hadi alayhi salam is the one who taught us the ziyarah, which is known as Ziyarah Jami'ah al-Kabira. Ziyarah Jami'ah al-Kabira is something which is a very rich treasure that we have from the Ahlul Bayt alayhim as-salam. When you look at the great treasures that we have, the Ahlul Bayt alayhim as-salam gave us treasures in the form of knowledge, in the form of supplications, in the form of ziyarat. Ziyarat meaning texts that we can recite when we want to talk to them, that introduce who they are and their characteristics. Ziyarat Jami'ah al-Kabira is one of the most famous and one of the greatest texts that we have for the ziyarah of the Ahlul Bayt alayhim as-salam. Ziyarat Jami'ah al-Kabira, Ayatollah Jawadi Amudi, hafidhahullah, one of the greatest scholars who is alive today, just to give you an idea of how great Ziyarat Jami'ah al-Kabira is, he says that if you want to know its greatness, then look at Dua Joshan al-Kabir. All of us are probably familiar with Dua Joshan al-Kabir. In Dua Joshan al-Kabir, we have been taught by our Prophet approximately 1,000 names of Allah. And these names of Allah encompass all different dimensions of Allah's greatness and perfection. Somebody who doesn't have the introduction and the profile that Dua Joshan al-Kabir gives us, they might think of God as being, like for example, a God who is a creator, but not one who's very involved with our daily lives. Or they might think of God as being involved with our daily lives and being very powerful and mighty, but not being very merciful. Or they might think of him as being merciful and being mighty, but not being very just, or so on and so forth. And you see people throughout history have come up with different notions of who God is. And many times, their understanding of God is limited. But the teachings of the Qur'an and the teachings of the Ahlul Bayt, they show us that Allah is perfect and He is completely perfect in all dimensions. We can't limit Him and say He's this, but He's not that. And one of the best reflections of that is the dua which is known as Joshan al-Kabir. And every month of Ramadan, we get a chance to go through that and we call upon Allah by all those perfect names. Now similarly, when it comes to the Ahlul Bayt, when it comes to the Imams, alayhim as-salam, there are people who have sometimes a limited understanding of the role of the Imams. For example, there are people who say that, well, the Imams are great. Why are they great? Because they are the children and the family of the Prophet, sallallahu alayhi wa alayhi. Now, because they're the family of the Prophet, that's why they're great. And why are they great? Because of that. And that's pretty much it. And there are many Muslims who don't understand anything about the greatness of the Ahlul Bayt beyond the fact that they are the family of the Prophet. What have they done? They've limited the understanding. There are others who say that, oh, we understand that they are the children of the Ahlul Bayt, and they are useful to us when we commit sins. Why? Because we know that one of the greatest ways of getting Allah's forgiveness and His mercy is by going to the doorstep of the Ahlul Bayt and asking and begging the forgiveness of Allah at their doorstep. So we see throughout history, many people have traveled to the shrines of the Ahlul Bayt and they've said that, you know, we're sinners, you know, we need forgiveness from Allah, and they've actually had transformational experiences. Even if they didn't recognize anything more about the Ahlul Bayt, just they understood that these are special people and their graves are special sites that we can get the mercy of and the forgiveness of Allah. That's sometimes the understanding. Sometimes people understand the Ahlul Bayt and they say that they are channels of Allah's rizq. There was a brother who for many years he was struggling. He really wanted children and he was not being given a child.
he was not a follower of the Ahlul Bayt per se. He was not somebody who had grown up, you know, being a Shia of the Ahlul Bayt. But he knew from his friends that one of the ways that you can be given and get the rizq of a child was to ask Imam Hussein alayhi salam. And so he makes a journey to Karbala, he goes for ziyarah, he asks at the grave of Imam Hussein alayhi salam, and sure enough, soon afterwards, he's given a child, and that becomes a way for him to accept the Ahlul Bayt alayhi salam and to become a Shia. Now, many people, that's their understanding of the Ahlul Bayt alayhi salam, that they are portals and channels by which we get the rizq of Allah. But when we come to the ziyarah of Jama Kabira, Ayatul Jawadi Amali says, he says that here, just like in Dua Ajoshan Kabir, what that does for our understanding of Allah, similarly, Ziyarat Jama Kabira, it helps us to understand that we cannot limit the greatness of the Ahlul Bayt alayhi salam. For example, in that ziyarah, we say that the Ahlul Bayt are Sasatul Ibad wa Arkanul Bilad. Sasatul Ibad, literally it means the ones who are in charge of the siyasa of the servants of God. Meaning they are the ones who are in charge of governing the affairs of Allah's creation. And they are Arkanul Bilad, meaning that they are the pillars of the civilization of human beings. Now, if you go and study and ponder upon these two descriptions, you see that the role of the Ahlul Bayt is much more than maybe we might perceive. When we look at, for example, the way that civilizations are run, we think about, well, what's the formal system of governance? You know, who's in charge? Where's the prime minister? Where's the president? Where's the cabinet? Where's the parliament? And we think about that. We think about all the structures, and we think about the economics, you know, the financial system, political system. But behind the scenes, what's really holding it up is the Ahlul Bayt alayhi salam. So these are the types of, you know, teachings that we are given in Ziyarat Jamia Kabira.
You're listening to Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran. This program entitled Minbar. Our email address is englishradio@irib.ir.
Rahi Karimun Azim Alimun Halim Hakimun Mateen Ghafur Shakurun Wadud Qayyumun Rauf Saburun Majid. محمد وآل محمد يا مؤمنين صلوا عليه.
We are with you. What about you? IRIB English Radio.
The Limelight. Virologists have voiced concerns about the emergence of yet another fast-spreading Omicron variant, which is rapidly gaining ground in India and has already arrived in the United Kingdom. The article you're about to hear has been written by The Guardian columnist Linda Geddes. The piece is titled Centaurus: Virologists Express Concern at New COVID Subvariant. Virologists have voiced concerns about the emergence of yet another fast-spreading Omicron variant, which is rapidly gaining ground in India and has already arrived in the United Kingdom. The BA.2.75 variant, nicknamed Centaurus, was first detected in India in early May. Here, cases have since risen steeply and apparently faster than those of the extremely transmissible BA.5 variant, which is also present in India and is rapidly displacing the previously dominant BA.2 variant in many countries. BA.2.75 has also since been detected in about 10 other countries, including the United Kingdom, United States, Australia, Germany, and Canada. The European Centre for Disease Prevention and Control, the ECDC, designated it a variant under monitoring on 7th of July, meaning there's some indication that it could be more transmissible or associated with more severe disease, but the evidence is weak or has not yet been assessed. The World Health Organization, WHO, is also closely monitoring the new variant, although its chief scientist, Dr. Soumya Swaminathan, said there weren't yet enough samples to assess its severity. In addition to its apparent rapid growth and wide geographical spread, virologists have been alerted by the sheer number of extra mutations BA.2.75 contains relative to BA.2, from which it is likely to have evolved. This could mean that it has had the chance to evolve an advantage over an already successful virus lineage, said Dr. Stephen Griffin, a virologist at the University of Leeds in England. It's not so much the exact mutations, more the number and combination, said Dr. Tom Peacock, a virologist at Imperial College London, who was the first to identify Omicron as a potential concern back in November of 2021. It's hard to predict the effect of that many mutations appearing together. It gives the virus a bit of a wildcard property where the sum of the parts could be worse than the parts individually. It is definitely a potential candidate for what comes after BA.5. Failing that, it's probably the sort of thing will have come along next. That is, a variant of a variant. Even if it doesn't take off in other countries, its growth in India suggests it is likely to be an issue there at the very least. Dr. Peacock added, it's clearly growing pretty well in India, but India hasn't got much BA.5, and it's still very unclear how well it fares against that. Dr. Stephen Griffin cited it as yet another example of the virus's impressive capacity to tolerate changes in its spike protein, the part it uses to infect cells, and which most COVID vaccines are based on. This time last year, many were convinced that Delta variant represented an evolutionary pinnacle for the virus, but the emergence of the Omicron variant and the vast increases in variability and antibody evasiveness is a sign that we cannot, as a population, follow an influenza-like plan to keep pace with the viral evolution, said Dr. Griffin. In addition to vaccines, longer-term plans should include variant-agnostic measures to prevent infections and reinfections. This includes creating infection-resilient environments through improved ventilation, improved filtration or sterilization of indoor air, sensible reprovision of lateral flow tests, and appropriate and supported isolation periods that will actually reduce ongoing transmission, he said. Meanwhile, COVID cases have risen almost 20% in a week, with 1 in 25 people in England thought to have had the disease at the end of June, official figures suggest. As a leading statistician said, hospitalizations from the latest surge may be topping off. According to the latest data from the Office for National Statistics, based on swabs collected from randomly selected households, an estimated 2.7 million people in Britain had COVID in the week ending 29 or 30th of June, an 18% rise on the week before, when almost 2.3 million people had the virus. In England alone, the most recent figure suggests about 1 in 25 people had a COVID infection in the last week of June, with a figure 1 in 17 in Scotland. Further analysis revealed infection levels had risen across all regions of England and in all age groups. These increases are due to rises in infections with the Omicron subvariants BA.4 and BA.5, which have been dominant since mid-June, said Sarah Crofts, the head of the analytical outputs for the COVID-19 infection survey. Scotland continues to have the highest infection rate, although it has recently increased at a slower rate compared with other regions of Britain. The total number of people in hospital in England who have tested positive for COVID stood at 11,878 on Thursday, an increase of 33% from the week before. While an increase was also evident in the number of people in hospital primarily due to COVID, with 3,749 such patients in England alone as of 5th of July.
You have just listened to the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran broadcasting. The Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran is broadcast daily from 1930 to 2030 UTC on the following frequencies. 31 meters, 9,855 kilohertz for Europe, and 31 meters, 9,835 kilohertz for Southern Africa, and FM 91.5 MHz for Tehran. You can also listen to the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran on Hotbird, Eutelsat 3B, and IranSat or Bat 5, and via the Internet. Our Internet address is parstoday.com/en. And now you can listen to IRIB English Radio via your mobile phone. Please refer to our website for the details. Please send your correspondence to the English program P.O. Box number 19395-6767, Tehran, Islamic Republic of Iran, or email us to englishradio@irib.ir. We would be very pleased to have your comments about audio quality and other means. Thank you.
بسم الله الرحمن الرحيم
السلام عليكم ورحمة الله
Selection of Ayatollah Khamenei's viewpoints
همه با وجود قده سرطانی اسرائیل مخالفیم
All of us are opposed to the cancer's tumor, Israel
وجه مشترک همه وحدت امت اسلامی
Unity of Islamic Ummah is the aspect that all of Islamic denominations have in common.
A major benefit brought by Imam Khomeini was familiarizing people with the concept of resistance. This is the part of the speech delivered on June 4th, 2022 by Imam Khomeini, the leader of the Islamic Revolution. On the 33rd demise anniversary of Imam Khomeini, greetings be upon him. The dismembered body of Shahid Soleimani was bid farewell by millions of people. The people commemorated and respected a revolutionary and mujahid person who had laid down his life for the Islamic Republic like that. This is one example. There are many other examples as well, such as the case of religious scholars. The late Ayatollah Safi Gulpayegani was a marja taqlid, religious authority and faqih and jurisprudent. Notice what a great movement the people launched in his burial ceremony. The late Ayatollah Bahjat was a mystic and faqih. In his burial and farewell ceremony, the people of Qom filled that city with their emotions. People from other cities too went to Qom for his burial ceremony. You tell me, for which other person from among outstanding political, artistic, and athletic personalities of the country would the people show such emotions? What does this show? Does this show the people's loss of belief in the clergy? Does it show the people's disbelief in religion, jihad, and resistance? They make such analysis. Their analyses are like this.
دنیای اسلام یک نسخه امروز دارد و اون اتحاد.
The world of Islam has one single prescription today, and that is unity. This prescription exists in all Islamic countries. Nations should be united.
Notice what the people are doing about the song that has been released these days, which is an expression of one's love for the Imam of the age. May God hasten his reappearance, and our souls may be sacrificed for his sake, and a greeting to him. Notice how enthusiastically they express their love. People, young, old, teenagers, children, women and men throughout the country do so. They do so in Tehran, Mashhad, Isfahan, Yazd, all in different ways. What is the reason for this? Is this a sign of people turning their backs on religion? Or is the other way around? In the beginning of the revolution, we did not have these things. In the beginning of the revolution, we did not witness the rushing of young students towards the centers of i'tikaf. We did not used to witness such great religious gatherings. Today, these things exist. So they have made a mistake about the Iranian nation. I could equally mention the 22nd of Bahman rallies. It is 43 years now that the people organize magnificent rallies on the 22nd of Bahman or on Quds Day. Is this a sign that the people have turned their backs on the revolution? This is a reason for the loyalty, resistance, and steadfastness of the people.
Allah, I want to thank you. I want to thank you for all the things that you've done for me through all my years. I've been lost. You guided me from all the ways that were wrong.
This is IRIB English Radio.
Please log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.